You are listening to KBBI, and you are tuned to The Coffee Table. I'm your host, Aaron Bolton, and in the studio with me this morning, I have current House District 31 Representative Paul Seaton. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, glad to.
And I just want to start by noting that we did invite Republican nominee Sarah Vance to join us on The Coffee Table, but she has declined to appear on the show. And I just wanted to start out, why are you running? This is your ninth time running for this particular seat, although the districts have changed over the years, but this is your ninth time running. Why? What made you decide to run again?
Well, last session, we worked on a four-pillar plan to actually get us out of this economic situation we're in, and we passed that out of the House, and that would have eliminated the big financial crisis we're having, but it couldn't get through the Senate. So I'm looking for some changes in the Senate so that they actually start addressing the issues of the state, and so hopefully we can go there. And I think that, you know, I've been working on solutions for a long time in the legislature and proposing those, and so I think that expertise is needed, as well as my experience. We don't want to be repeating the problems that were done in the past here, and we need some historic knowledge as well.
And I want to remind listeners, if you do have a question, you can call in at 235-7721. Again, 235-7721. You can also email your questions to info@kbbi.org. And please do include your name with your questions if you're emailing in, just so we know who is asking. And and I've heard you say that your ability to compromise is needed in the legislature right now, and in terms of what you've been pushing for as far as your fiscal plan proposal. What are some examples of compromises you've made during your last term, and what are some compromises we could possibly expect in your next term if you're reelected?
Well, during this last term, of course, I'm the co-chair of the Finance Committee in the House for the operating budget, and so basically, it comes down to the end compromising between the Senate budget and the House budget, because we passed different budgets with somewhat different goals in mind. And so those come down in the end, and we have to figure those out. So there were a lot of those. Some things that, I was very supportive of was making sure we had full funding of education, and those things we got a compromise. I proposed a bill to actually change the way we fund education. And for this year, we early funded education, separated the budget from the general operating budget. And that meant that we didn't get pink slips all over the state going out because of late budgetary. And so the next legislature can follow that model. They don't have to. So anyway, that's one of the things. We also worked really hard and got forward funding of education for next year. So we've got that piece off the table, and included in that was a $30 million one-time funding for next year. So basically a $10 million increase over this year. We'll kind of take care of inflation. We're really in status quo budgets on education, but at least we're really not going backwards to a significant degree.
And you mentioned your fiscal plan, and you've called it the four pillar plan. If you just want to give a short overview of what that entails.
Sure. There were basically four parts to it. One of them was changing the oil taxes. We are now getting the lowest percentage of oil tax in the history of our state. And we need to change that. We had, as part of that, it was called House Bill 111, but it was a bill that would have gotten us $700 million more in oil tax revenue. There was also a income tax that we proposed, although when we worked with the Senate, we said it needs to be a broad-based tax, but, you know, we prefer an income tax. But if you want to propose something else like a sales tax, we would consider it. So that's part of this give and take of you try and develop your best solution and then be willing to look at other solutions as well if people have ideas. And then we had the permanent fund earnings reserve, was going to be there, and we needed to take some money from that because there was not enough in our savings, constitutional budget reserve, to fund the budget. We couldn't balance the budget without taking some money from the earnings reserve. And so in the end, that's what we did, and we were looking at a higher percentage of that draw from the earnings reserve going to dividends than the Senate was, and that even in the end, at the very last minute, the Senate was still trying to negotiate for a lower amount of permanent fund dividends, putting in a percentage split, but, you know, they've wanted 25% is where they've always been stuck at, and we have said no. And so in the end, you know, we compromised and said, we will pass SB 26, but only as a limitation on the amount that the legislature can take from the earnings reserve. So instead of putting in what that split would be. And people do have to remember that we have a constitution in the state, and our constitution specifically says there can be no dedicated funds. So when we talk about passing a bill that says this is what's going to happen in the future, we're giving an indication of what we think would be best. But the next legislature is going to have to make those determinations. And people that say that there can be automatic payments, those are just not true at all unless it's in the Constitution.
And, you know, and so I wanted to kind of go into some of this. In you know, reforming the permanent fund earnings reserve and restructuring that and kind of how it's used, it is, as you mentioned, already passed. And we spoke last week, and we didn't have a chance to air this portion of our conversation. So, you know, I want to ask you again, and you kind of just touched on this. This legislature passed a roughly 5% draw on the permanent fund earnings reserve, with a portion of that going to pay PFDs and the rest going towards, you know, state government. And the bill was said to have reduced this year's gap by from $2.4 billion to $700 million. But the split, as you mentioned, was not implemented into that bill. And you mentioned it was because of the Constitution that can't be said. If you kind of want to explain that a little bit more as far as why would that be considered a dedicated fund if you implemented the split for future legislatures to follow?
Well, when our founders were looking at the Constitution, we were one of the latest constitutions of all the states, of course. And they looked around at the states, and many of the states had huge problems because past legislatures had come along and said, we're going to have a sales tax, and that's going to be dedicated to a certain thing, and that's all it can be spent on. And those that didn't have a prohibition on dedicated funds means that here is this law that goes there, and that's the way the money is spent. So the legislature was sitting there not being able to respond to current economic conditions. And so it tied the hands of the ability of the people that are elected to draw up a balanced budget to be able to do that. And so our founding fathers have a direct provision. I could read it for you from the Constitution if you want, but it's prohibits dedicated funds. And so every penny that is taken out of the Treasury to be spent on anything has to be appropriated every year. We have some people that think that the PFD, which was a statute, automatically spends out that money, and that is not true at all. In fact, our Constitution, when it established the permanent fund, it says directly that all of the earnings from the all of the income from the permanent fund will be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law, and we otherwise provided by law by forming the earnings reserve account and having the permanent fund corporation to manage that for the maximum yield. But you can't draw out and make an automatic payment, because then it becomes a dedicated fund, which is prohibited in the Constitution. And so that's where we are. People just need to understand that we are governed by the Constitution, and past statutes that have passed tell us what they would like, what that legislature would like to do, but you can't bind the next legislature. And I mean, it's just like the longevity bonus is still active statute. It has been declared unconstitutional because it didn't treat people equally in the state, but it's still in the statutes. So when people say, well, that law isn't being followed, well, that's true, and that's a law longevity bonus that is not being followed at all. So anyway, that's where reality is.
And, you know, in my mind, you know, that means the battle over what, if any, money from the earnings reserve could be spent on state government each year isn't over. And we talked about this a little bit last week. A future legislature could effectively vote to put all the money from the current draw towards PFDs and nothing towards to state government. So, I mean, did that law setting up the ability to draw from state government really move us forward, or do you think the legislature is going to continue kind of arguing over how much is spent on government and how much goes towards PFDs?
Well, I think there'll be an argument there, but when you propose a plan that's multifunction, multifaceted, that gets you out of a hole that you're in, because we are definitely in a hole, and plans for the future, future legislatures are going to think long and hard before they modify that plan drastically, because if it's a plan that's working, that's there, and I think that it will take a lot to change that plan. I mean, everybody should realize that the entire amount in the earnings reserve is available for appropriation, and so the legislature has been very reticent to come in and appropriate money and spend any of that. We've just spent it on the PFDs, basically, and a few other things related to that, but that's consistent with what a past legislature did back in the 80s, but that's not necessarily consistent with the economics of this time. We've had some great, great returns, but all of the money in the earnings reserve, that's where all of the earnings go, and that's where all the losses go. So if there was a 20% stock market correction, all of the money on that $65 billion in the corpus and the earnings reserve, it's all invested as one account. It all comes out of the earnings reserve. So it could drop precipitously. I mean, we lost $3.3 billion in 1 week earlier because of a correction, 10% correction in the stock market. So people that think that only earnings go in there, all the losses on that entire amount that's invested in the principal as well, all of those losses come out of the earnings reserve immediately.
And, you know, and we've talked about this a little bit. There have been those who proposed enshrining a particular amount for the PFD in the Constitution or setting up a kind of a guarantee through statute of how much residents can expect for a PFD each year. I mean, do you also view that as something that would be unconstitutional? And then even if it were to be implemented and deemed okay or constitutional, I guess, do you see it? Is there a danger in your mind of guarantee a certain amount for PFD checks?
Well, let's be clear. There's two ways. One is in the Constitution. The other is in statute. And I think we're mixing the two of those up. If it's in statute, that's fine. It's telling the future legislatures, hey, this is what we think it should be. The 30th legislature thought that this should be a certain split. If it's in the Constitution, it means it will come first above everything else. So what, you know, we could get into the situation where we had less money in the earnings reserve and there was a drop in the stock market and there wasn't any money there. And that's where the PFD is paid out of the earnings. But if there are no earnings or not enough, that would mean that before you had education, before you had public safety, that formula would be followed. So if you're coming off a series of high earning years, if you're doing this 5-year average, you could have no earnings and you could have a big stock market or a depression or something come through, and you would have to pay that money out to individuals by that formula before you funded education, before you funded public safety, before you cleared the roads. And you would even have to take it, if there wasn't enough money in the earnings reserve, you would have to take it out of the general fund. And that means you would be cutting all of those things. And that's, you know, that's one of the problems we have with people saying, we're going to pay the old formula, and that's it. And we're not going to have any new taxes or new revenues, or we're not going to change oil taxes. So the only way you can do that, if you, unless you're going to go above that sustainable draw and just raid the permanent fund for any amount that you need, then you're going to have to cut that in state government. And if you cut that in state government, this last year we recalculated the budget as to what that would have been, and there would have been 17 agencies that would have been zero funded in the state of Alaska if we had paid that $3,000, $870 million more out of that draw. Wouldn't have gone to pay for essential services, and that would have defunded 17 agencies. And that's everything from fish and game, zero money for fish and game, zero money for DOT, zero money for Department of Commerce, Environmental Protection, the University of Alaska, all of those things. That's if we had kept K-12 education where it was and health and social services. And most of health and social services are shared responsibility with the federal government. And if we violate our amount, then we lose that federal money as well. So, you know, when you look at what the reality is on promises that some people are making, no taxes, no rating the permanent fund above the sustainable draw, and taking out cuts to the government, it's not efficiencies. It's 17 departments would have been zeroed out and 15,000 employees would have had to have been laid off. So that's two-thirds or more of the entire workforce in state government.
And so in your fiscal plan, you kind of separate reforming the permanent fund, earnings reserve, and maintaining and protecting the PFD. I mean, what if you want to explain kind of the separation there, I mean, what do you mean by maintaining and protecting the PFD when you're talking about your fiscal plan?
Well, the fiscal plan that we had made sure that we weren't overdrawing the earnings reserve. If you overdraw, take too much out of the earnings reserve so it is going down, then you're in a huge problem going forward, because then in a few years you don't have enough money in the earnings reserve to pay that, as well as you don't have the money to provide for essential services. Now, my view is that we should change oil taxes so it's a fair deal for Alaska. I mean, most people don't realize that the big oil companies are deducting 35% of all of their expenses as a tax credit. So they calculate their taxes, and then they take 35% of all of their expenses, and instead of transmitting their taxes to the state government, they take 35% of all their expenses and put that back in their own pocket. So that's a huge factor. I mean, in the bill that we produced in the four-pillar plan, $500 million of that $700 million came from reducing the amount that they could take in these tax credits. So we got rid of what were called cashable credits for the small companies, those that really weren't producing oil. That's a help because we're not just taking money out of the treasury and paying those, but they're still able to carry those forward and deduct them once they start producing at this 35% tax rate. Nobody's paying a 35% tax. I mean, they're paying at $60 a barrel, or $65, $66 a barrel, they're paying an 8% profit tax, but they're getting to take a 35% tax credit for their expenses. Makes no sense at all. The way a profits tax always works is that you get the benefit of the tax rate you're paying. And so that's why in the bill that we had, we lowered that basic tax rate from 35% to 25%. So we would have been paying 25% of their expenses on the North Slope instead of 35% of all their expenses on the North Slope. And so that is that's a huge challenge for the citizens of the state. We're now getting about 30% of our budget from oil, where we used to get 90%.
And so you mentioned the basically the deduction that they're able to write off of their expenses, but you know, and you want to lower the 25%, but you also mentioned in there that the profits tax isn't close to what they're able to write off. But the difference between 8% and 25% still seems a little bit large. Are you in favor of raising the profits tax, the amount that we tax them off the money they make?
Well, actually, we'd be lowering the basic tax rate from 35% to 25%. See, it wouldn't be bad if they were deducting their expenses, which is the normal case in a profits tax, then you're saving what percentage you're paying in taxes. But we give them a credit. So they, and a credit is you say take all that amount and then you take that 35% directly out of what you would have already, you know, calculated to pay the state. So it's a screwy system, and it needs to be changed. And but it, if we were just allowing them to deduct, that's a normal profits tax. But we're not doing that. We're giving them a tax credit instead of a tax deduction.
And you know, typically in the past, you've brought oil up, reforming oil and gas tax credits quite a bit lately. And typically in the past, I've heard you more talk more about implementing a broad-based tax. You know, is this? I don't know if there you have in a particular order you'd like the plan to be implemented in, or that you're pushing for. But is this taking a front seat over a broad-based tax? I mean, does this seem like this would be an easier portion of the plan to push through the legislature than a broad-based tax?
Well, it is. It doesn't get us out of the hole. It gets us, you know, some ways towards it, but it doesn't solve our fiscal problem long term. So that's why we were doing a comprehensive plan that would actually be there and have all these elements work together. There was about $700 million from oil taxes and oil credits. There was about $650 million, which would be the income tax portion. And there was about $600 million from the reduction of the PFD. So this was a balanced plan that went through and would have gotten us out of the out of where we were.
And, you know, and I actually wanted to ask about that. So, I mean, how much as our budget gap stands now with the draw on the permanent fund earnings reserve to pay for some state government, how much closer would reforming oil and gas tax credits the way you're proposing, how much closer would that get us to closing that gap? What would we be looking at in general?
Well, with the dividend where it was at $1,600, we had about a $600 million deficit. That is money that we're having to take out of the constitutional budget reserve. And it's only got 1.8, so that's, you know, if we're taking that much out every year, it's only 3 years. The oil tax and credit reform would have been $700 million. So we wouldn't have had a deficit. So that would have gotten us out of there for the short term. But what we really want to do is remember that we borrowed $12.5 billion from the constitutional budget reserve. And our constitution says that until that money is repaid, all of the money that's available gets swept into the constitutional budget reserve at the end of the fiscal year. So that's a loan. And so somehow we have to have a plan that will rebuild the constitutional budget reserve so that when the next oil crash comes and, you know, oil taxes go up and oil taxes go down. And so when the next one comes, we need a constitutional budget reserve there as a buffer so that we're not having to react immediately in that first year or raid the permanent fund or something else of that magnitude.
And, you know, I've heard you talk a lot about job creation, and as well as your opponent, Sarah Vance, has talked a lot about creating jobs as well and creating a stronger economy. What are some ways the legislature can get involved in job creation?
Well, you know, one of the things is that I've heard is a proposal for incentive zones. Well, incentives mean you are going to give something to get something. And the only thing that the state can give, because we have no tax on jobs, is to give money. And we don't have the money to give. So what we did do, it's been on in state law for a long time, is we allowed municipalities and boroughs to do a five-year reduction in property taxes or anything they wanted to. They came to us last year or the year before and said, this is not enough time and we can't recruit these big businesses in, so we want to have a longer time span. You know, we looked at that and we said, well, you know that we're worried about this. The reason it's 5 years is because when you have big corporations coming in, they can leverage the municipality hugely to build a facility. And if you give them 20, 30 years of no taxes, somebody else is going to have to be paying for those things. But basically, the Alaska Municipal League and others wanted this flexibility for longer term. But what I did was I said, hey, you know, remember that the required local contribution for schools is 2.65 mils. So that's a tax base on the whole taxable base of the borough that, or city, it wouldn't matter which. But remember, you have to have that money come in. So we can't allow you to give them all of their taxes free. And so we exempted it so that they had to have at least the minimum local contribution to schools paid for by this big whatever would be coming in. Maybe it's a big retailer, maybe it's a Walmart or something like that. If that came into a smaller community, that would be the biggest portion of their assessed valuation. And if we didn't have that part that I got put in, what would happen is all the surrounding houses and all the other businesses would have to pick up that 2.65 mils for this big assessed valuation on this big corporation that came in. And so we prevented that at least.
And I just want to remind listeners can call in at 235-7721 or you can email your questions to info@kbbi.org. And please include your name if you are going to be emailing your questions so we know who is asking. And we are going to take a short break before we come back. You are listening to The Coffee Table. Are tuned to KBBI and you're listening to The Coffee Table. I'm your host Aaron Bolton, and in the studio with me I have current Homer or House District 31 Representative Paul Seaton, who is running for re-election this election cycle. And before the break we were talking about a number of things, but I want to jump back to the PFD for just a minute. And we talked about this in our conversation last week. There are a number of voters who, of course, are angry about the reduction in PFD checks in recent years. And I guess what are you saying to some of those voters? I mean, it sounds like it's had an impact on some people's budgets in their households.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm, you know, I feel for that, and I know it hurt people, you know, let's face it, kids, seniors, people that don't have much income. It's a greater hit on them than anybody else. And of course, our problem is that we tried to get a comprehensive package through that wouldn't have made that hit so big, but and would have been balanced with an income tax. But that's not the where we could get with the Senate. The Senate was saying, and Pete Kelly and Kevin Meyer and others in leadership directly said, and they said it on in their news conferences and all as well, that they did not want to have any new income, any new taxes until they quit sending out checks to Alaskans, and that's the PFD. And so that was what we were up against. That was what Governor Walker was up against, you know, trying to do all of these things to get new revenue so that we could get out of this ditch that we were in. And the Senate just refused to do anything other than decrease the PFD and go to the earnings reserve of the permanent fund to fund government. That was the only solution that they would have. And we went in 2017, we were there for the longest sessions, combined sessions with special sessions in the history of the state, trying to move the Senate to address and diversify our revenue sources. And they just totally refused. And so there were no options on the table other than the earnings reserve of the permanent fund, because we had already the previous year taken more money than out of the earnings reserve. So there wasn't enough this last year to even pay the, even if we'd zeroed out our entire savings account, borrowed all of the money out of there, there was no way to balance budget.
And we just got a question in, and I may pronounce your last name incorrectly, but Catherine Carso, your opponent proposes to close the fiscal gap by increasing state worker productivity with the help of a consultant to improve morale and to develop enterprise zones to spur business development and create jobs. We've touched on that second point a little bit. We can get to that, but why don't we start with the first as far as increasing state worker productivity? And Catherine asks, are these viable solutions?
Well, state workers are handling more than they've ever handled in the past. We have and a tremendous workforce that are handling more jobs individually than they have more. We got to remember there's 3,000 fewer people hired in the state right now by the state government than there were just a couple of years ago. So all of those jobs are still being done, but they're being done by the workforce. So you know, this idea of auditing or bringing outside consultants in to see, you know, we did that. When Representative Hawker was the co-chair of the finance division, we passed a bill on performance audits. And what we were going to do is we hired these outside consultants to come in and look at each of the departments. It was on a 10-year schedule so that all the departments would be have this performance review, which is what we're talking about in that. We spent millions of dollars, and they came in and went through all these, some of the departments, and we found that, gee, we weren't getting enough suggestions for efficiency upgrades to even buy these private consultants to even pay for the audit. And so they were expensive. We discontinued doing those. Because they just weren't economically efficient at all. And so we have a great workforce that's working hard, whether it doesn't matter whether it's on the roads or whether it's in the planning processes, but we've got such a backlog. Now, I mean, a good example is the review of the fire marshal's permits, reviewing the plans. Well, there are fewer people now. It used to be there were two segments. One reviewed oil and gas plans and the other reviewed all the commercial plans. Well, now we've lost people there so that the oil and gas is now in the same queue with regular construction. So we have people here in Homer that weren't able to start their businesses because they were waiting just for a review of the fire plans because they get stuck in this long queue with fewer people doing more jobs. So.
In the second portion of that question, and we do want to touch on it again a little bit, in the development of enterprise zones to spur business development and create jobs. And you mentioned that the legislature did give municipalities a five-year window to work out some of these deals with some potentially large retailers or corporations coming in to do some kind of business. And you mentioned a concern about not allowing those corporations to leverage zero property taxes, for example, and you at least required the minimum amount of the mill rate that would have to go towards education. Are there other concerns about what corporations could leverage out of municipalities beyond just property taxes?
Well, sure. And just to be clear, it had been a five-year window that everybody had. And so this has been allowed, these economic improvement zones or incentive zones or whatever you want to call them, by boroughs and municipalities for 5 years. And that was previously. And I think it was either 2 or 3 years ago, we went ahead and increased that length of time to it's unlimited now. So... But we put in the stipulation at my insistence that they had to at least be paying their required local contribution. So anyway, this is something that's been allowed in the state for a long time. So unless you're going to have some incentive from the state, which since there is no state property tax on other than oil and gas, and there is no state income tax or state sales tax, the only kind of incentive you can talk about is paying them money. And when you're paying somebody money to come in and compete against the existing businesses there, I'm not in favor of that because you are so drastically skewing the private economy and competition that it is just not appropriate.
And we will jump to the income tax, but since we're on the topic of job creation at the moment, I want to continue on that vein. And is job creation beneficial for the state outside of oil and gas industries or even the new growing marijuana industry, industries that have a tax revenue stream tied back to the state? Because if you create jobs in some industries that aren't providing a large tax revenue stream to the state, effectively the state seems to be losing out on that. I mean, is it still beneficial for the state in any way to focus on job creation? Or I guess we can tie this back to your idea of an income tax. I mean, does an income tax or a broad-based tax need to come first before the state focuses more on job creation?
Well, job creation is something we all want to see because that stimulates the base private economy. But there's nothing, unless it's a C corporation, that's the regular big corporations. If you're a LLC, you don't pay any tax to the state. If you're a partnership or a sole proprietor, you pay nothing to the state in taxes. So yeah, just getting over that to begin with, there is no state property tax, state income tax, or state sales tax on individuals or businesses. There is a corporate income tax. So anyway, if it's a C corporation, then there is something that comes in. But just clarifying that. So it is costly because the more people you have in, the more schools you have to build. We just saw the budget here where even though this would have been the cheapest option ever, I think, for the borough at a bond issue for $5 million for a school for 60 kids, all the rest was being paid by the state, and people didn't want to do that. So we get in some difficult situations when there's no money that comes to the state from jobs. But economic activity is really important. I mean, it's really important to all of us, but there has to be at some point, unless oil is going to pay for everything like it did in the past, you have to get somewhere where you're, where you have a source. I mean, every other state in the union, in the whole United States, has one of those, if not multiple, of those broad-based tax. Most of them have two. Either a sales tax and an income tax, or a sales tax and a property tax, or a sales tax and an income tax and property tax. So we're the only one the outlier there, and everybody else has figured out how you need to get money to run a state, run the services that are desired by the people. But we'll just have to see.
And we do have a caller on the line, and we'll get to that in a second. But you did mention, you know, there is a corporate tax, you know, on C corporations. I mean, is you know, and we were just talking about the enterprise zones trying to create some incentives for these potentially large corporations to come in. Is the revenue we get from a corporate tax large enough for the state to be trying to incentivize those kind of businesses to show up here? I mean, does it pencil out or in terms of what the state receives and what it may be putting in terms of incentives?
Well, it's a 9.4% maximum profit tax. So if you're on the lower end of the scale, you're paying much, much less. But if you're, you know, I forget where that's $500,000 or something and above, I think is where it is. But don't quote me on that because I don't remember. It could be $300,000 and above total profit. So if you, at that, you pay 9.4%. So that doesn't pay very much for schools and those things, but it is a help and it is a contribution. And I'm not dismissing the corporate income tax at all. But most of the businesses that are coming in aren't C corporations. Most of them are partnerships, sub-S corporations. They don't pay the corporate tax. And that's one of the problems we have, too. We've got four major producers of oil and gas, and one of those is a S corporation. So they don't pay any corporate income tax at all in oil and gas sector as well.
Okay, and we have Kelly on the line. You are on the coffee table. Go ahead, Borough Assembly Member Kelly Cooper, if you want to go ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about the crime bill, SB 91. There are so many people that say it should be repealed. And so I would like to know, or I'd like to ask you to explain the changes that have been made in this last session and what other changes you hope to continue to make for the following session.
All right. Thanks for your call, Kelly.
Sure. And most of the changes that have been suggested have been made in three bills that we've passed. We passed a technical change bill, which was Senate Bill 55, which there were discrepancies between federal statutes and Alaska law and in the Violence Against Women Act. And so we changed those. We fixed a loophole to enforce protective orders and reaffirmed local jurisdiction control over traffic violations. Those things had gotten messed up, as well as ensured the court had reasonable discretion in sentencing for youthful and full first-time offenders. That's the youth court and those kind of things. There was some question as to whether those were out, and so we made sure that those were back in. Then we had SB 54, which was a chief one that returned the offense of violating a condition of release to a crime and removed a loophole which made it difficult to prosecute categories of sex trafficking. We also gave the courts the discretion to sentence first-time felonies, that's C felonies, for up to 2 years in jail. That had been taken out in SB 91. That was returned for the courts to be able to do that. So there can be accountability. The courts have that discretion. Then we also had SB or House Bill 312, which reinstated the use of the out-of-state criminal history in pre-trial release decisions. We eliminated that mandatory release for pretrial. So those are most of the issues. It, you know, that one also gave the Attorney General the ability to list new controlled substances on a temporary basis, because we were getting new drugs come in, and until the legislature met and passed a bill, they couldn't be looked at as controlled substances. So we got over that problem as well. And we did increase surcharges for felons for an increasing restitution. So those were really important things we did, as well as we also did the safe school support. And then we also did the rape kits, reform. We put money into that. So we put $34 million into improving justice. So when people talk about us increasing the budget, a good portion of that, $34 million of that, came in $12 million for treatment plant, treatment of drug addiction. We don't want people coming out and then not having any treatment and reoffending again. So, and we enhanced 911, $3.5 million, as well as VPSOs and the $75 million or $75,000 that we put in for these small grants for Neighborhood Watch programs. So those are some of the things that we did. And so what we're left with SB 91 is we have the pretrial supervising officers. That whole thing, if we just repealed SB 91, we wouldn't have the pretrial enforcement, bail officers. Those would be gone. And so that would be terrible, because that's the accountability that you need to have when you release somebody. Remember, SB 91 was passed because we had 40% of the people sitting in jail just because they couldn't post the cash bails that were at that time. So getting rid of cash bails had some, you know, lowered those costs, but at the time, it shouldn't have been done that way because we didn't have the pretrial service officers on for monitoring the people out on bail, as well as the ankle monitoring thing. So repealing SB 91 would not be a smart deal at this point in time, because it's been repaired. Now, there are a couple other repairs that need to be done, such as, you know, if somebody in domestic violence situation comes in and does a property crime, that's not enhanced domestic violence. It has to be an offense against a person. So we need to look at that. There's a couple of little things there that we need to look at. And the governor's came out with a large 80-some different items that he would like to see addressed. Some of them in 91, but most of them just things we need to do to change the criminal justice system so we get actual accountability.
And we have just about 10 minutes left, and I do want to get to the income tax, but the, you know, and I think you followed up on most of my questions in terms of SB 91. But in terms of the people in Alaskans who oppose SB 91, who support the idea of repealing it, I guess what's your pitch to them in terms of do they need to hold out and see if some of these fixes you're talking about work for them, or I guess what would you say to voters who support repealing SB 91?
Well, I mean, repeal SB 91 is a good bumper sticker to say we want crime fixed. But we've passed three bills fixing portions of that that have corrected those measures, instituted new. So when you say that repeal 91, then the question is, do we eliminate the pretrial officers, and do we eliminate the ankle monitoring? Those are the things that give accountability to people that are out on pretrial release. Or do we go back and say, okay, we want to have 40% of the people in jail. We want a bigger jail population that just because they can't post bail. We need accountability, but that accountability needs to be that when people are waiting for trial, they are there. I mean, I've been surprised on other radio stations, there are all these ads that blame me for something. I mean, and that's on the Republicans on the Kenai Peninsula. Senator Machicki was a co-sponsor of this bill. He's never introduced a repeal, or it's never passed the Senate at all, never even come up. So, you know, I think people need to take responsibility for the bills that they sponsor and they co-sponsor. And, you know, instead of blaming others, it was a Senate bill and he was a co-sponsor. The Republicans were all co-sponsors of that bill, as well as having the most conservative, arguably one of the most conservative senators, Senator Coghill, was the prime sponsor of that bill. So, you know, trying to slough off the responsibility for crime onto others that weren't the sponsors or co-sponsors of that bill, to me, is just hypocrisy.
But you have mentioned in the past, or I guess first you should ask, did you vote in favor of the original SB 91 bill?
The original bill came over to us, and we had 4 days of debate on the floor. First of all, it went through and got modified quite a bit, toughened up in the Judiciary Committee, and then it came to the floor. There were a lot of amendments because this was when we were meeting in a different building because the state capitol was under a seismic retrofit for earthquake damage, and so we were 4 days of testimony. I don't remember how all of those went. There were some of them that I voted for and some of the amendments I didn't vote for. The bill went back as it was amended over to the Senate, and the senators that we're talking about voted for the bill as it came back to them. I mean, they could have not voted for it and gone to conference committee and negotiated those items if there was something they didn't like, but they didn't do that.
Yeah, well, I understand that you voted for some items and potentially not for others if, in terms of amendments, but there would have been a final vote on the House floor, correct?
Oh, yeah, I believe I did, yeah. Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, this is all based on the Criminal Justice Committee or Commission. Their recommendations, some of those were modified, but I voted for it, but I wasn't one of the sponsors, or I really wasn't involved. I'm not on the Judiciary Committee, and you follow those things and you vote the way the arguments are on the floor, mm-hmm. but you're not involved like a sponsor or co-sponsor in the development of the bill.
Right. We have just a few minutes left, but I want to touch on the income tax. If you want to, in short, explain what your proposal in terms of, you say you prefer a statewide income tax, if you want to explain that proposal.
Sure. And really, I think that the simplest way is the way I introduced it first. And of your federal tax, the amount that you would pay in federal tax, you'd pay 15% of that. So not on your income, but based on what you paid in federal tax. And so, you know, there's some advertisements out there that a family would have to pay $7,000 in income tax. You know, the only way you'd pay $7,000 if you were paying the federal government more than $49,000 per year, then you might have a $7,000 state income tax. And it's progressive income tax. It'd be the... It is because the federal tax is progressive. So I think going back to that way of calculating it, I mean, it's harder to collect money from non-residents based on the federal tax because they're going to have to submit their entire federal tax to the state of Alaska. If you did it on the taxable income, then you knew what was taxable in the state of Alaska, the money that was earned here by non-residents. So it made it easier, and we went to that, but it got a little confusing to people. They thought it was different, but, you know, it's not a 15% tax rate, 15% of the tax that you would pay to the federal government. So it turns out about 3%.
Okay, and you mentioned, we talked about this a little bit before in terms of your overall fiscal plan proposal. You mentioned that if all the pieces, if they were put together, that it would allow us to rebuild the CBR and give us kind of a buffer. I mean, is there, and I know that the budget deficit and the budget is always shifting and moving, but is there a general idea of how much of a surplus that would put us over to end up start rebuilding some of those accounts? How much extra money would we be able to put towards the CBR each year if all the pieces were implemented?
Well, hopefully, I mean, of course, everything was up for negotiation, but the Senate never negotiated on anything. So we don't know what portion of the oil tax they would have done. You know, it could have been that we reached a better compromise. But, you know, in that way, we were just balanced our budget, basically, is where we got to. And so I would say that, you know, if we were looking at something, we need to have a rebuild schedule of the CBR over 10 years. So, you know, that would be the ideal. And so as things go forward, that would be helpful. I mean, we need to reform our mining taxes. Our royalty on mining taxes right now is based on net income, which doesn't make any sense at all because a royalty is supposed to be the value of the material, of the minerals taken out. And so, you know, this our current royalty on mining has never been changed. It was just put in as kind of a placeholder, 3% of net. Well, if your expenses are real high, there's no net income. So all of the minerals leave Alaska without any net, without any income staying here. And so, you know, there's a number of things that need to be changed over time to make Alaska fair and equitable across all our population.
All right, and we have just about a minute left if you want to make, I guess, your final pitch to voters.
Well, sure, and thanks. And, you know, I think my experience is really important. We have, I've been chairman of many committees in the House of Representatives. I know those issues. I have a knowledge, and I can compromise with people. And I think that in the end, we need to make sure that we're doing things that are fair for all Alaskans. And so I'd really ask for a people's vote on or before. I think, you know, early voting takes place now. It'd be nice to get that done. So if we have a storm at the time on Tuesday the 6th, we don't have people missing votes. So thank you very much.
Hardy, thanks for joining us. And you have been listening to The Coffee Table here on KBBI AM 890 Homer. I'm your host, Aaron Bolton.